Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. We're going to do a couple of very quick work sessions today, and then we will take up the public hearings that we have posted today. And we will, well, Paul, let's start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 553.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you heard Senate Bill 553 on March 21st. You also had it up as part of your discussion with the stability package, and it's back again today. You have a dash one amendment to it, which provides some technical changes. Essentially, what it does is it redirects interest earnings that currently flow to the general fund. If they're not specifically allocated somewhere else, they go to the general fund. What it does is direct those interest earnings now into the Oregon Rainy Day Fund, the statutory reserve fund at the end of the biennium. The amounts transferred are subtracted from the calculation for the up to 1% of prior biennium appropriations ending balance that goes into the Rainy Day Fund. So if you had $100 million ending balance, which is less than 1%, $30 million in interest earnings, you'd have a $70 million transfer from the ending balance, and then the 30 from interest earnings. The time when it would make a difference would be if you had an ending balance of, say, $70 million, and you had interest earnings of $80 million. $80 million would go to the rainy day fund rather than 70.
Okay.
So those are the times that make a difference.
Thank you, Paul. In committee, as you recall, we sent our stability package out of this committee recently, and one of those components was a mandatory savings provision. Senate Bill 553 would be another approach for some kind of disciplined savings into the Rainy Day Fund. So what I would prefer is to send it down to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, which is where the other mandatory savings piece is going, and in hopes that one or both or some combination of them could eventually get us a mandatory savings measure. So, Senator Morris, if you're comfortable with that, Senator Hess.
Just a question for Paul. Thank you. There's always this language about the Oregon University system and the interest money from there would go into this fund. And I remember we talked about this when this earlier, but why is that language in there? And with the measure that's pending in Ways and Means, Senate Bill 242, that says interest earnings no longer can be taken, how does this work with that?
Senator Hess, it's my understanding that that does not, that's not current law now in terms of those general fund interest earnings. The higher ed has other fund interest earnings that can be retained for tuition, for example. And it has general fund interest earnings that have been traditionally calculated as part of this. What would happen if that bill passed, and this one did too, is that the amount of general fund interest earnings would be less than what are calculated. Actually, have on the back of your revenue impact statement. These are assuming current law in which those higher ed interest earnings are included in that. If that bill passes, then you just have a smaller amount that would be transferred to the rainy day fund.
Great.
Okay, thank you. Other questions before we ask Senator Morris for a motion on the dash one amendment? Okay, Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 553 dated Paul 2-16-11.
Senator Morris has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 553. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 553 as amended with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 553 as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by subsequent referral. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, that does that. And now we have our full legislative contingent here for one of our bills. I think I'll start out by opening a public hearing today on House Bill 2543. Representative Berger, are you here on any other bills?
No.
Okay.
I'm not sure why I'm here.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2543 makes a number of changes to the Senior and Disabled Deferral Program. I will just highlight some of the major changes and issues that might be left to discuss. First thing that that they did was the measure implements a asset check for initial entry into the program with a limit of $500,000 in assets. The measure also requires that participants recertify their income every 2 years and changes from a federally adjusted gross income test to a household income test that's more comprehensive in order to continue the qualification for the program. The measure would require that new applicants be in their homes for 5 years before participating. There is a real market value test that is proposed to be implemented according to basically, the participants could have a range of 100% of median county RMV all the way up to 200% of the median RMV in their county, depending on how many years they've been in their home. And there's a schedule of that in the language of this measure. The measure changes the interest rate from 6% simple to 6% compound interest. There's a 10-year sunset date on the entire program. Furthermore, there's a limit on the growth of new participants in the program at 5% a year, starting in 2011 and going at 5% thereafter. And the reason for that would be that the senior population is growing at about approximately that rate. So this would allow the program to expand with population, but not anymore. Possibly with economic conditions, there could be greater demand for the program and could cause problems with the funding of the program. There has been some discussion about what kinds of criteria would be used to determine if the applicants go over 5%, who would receive be able to participate in the program and who wouldn't. And currently, the measure sorts out people that those with the lowest tax rate would be, or lowest tax would be granted the participation first, and then people would progressively.
The lowest tax, you mean income?
No, the taxable property tax, bill in total, and it's just based on the lowest bill to the highest bill, and wherever they the cutoff is, that would be the criteria for that cut. And so there's been some criticism of that maybe it should be based on the relative value of the home relative to a county median, because some places are going to have higher tax property tax bills than others. And so that might be an outstanding issue. And this measure would also potentially, if the program had run out of money, the counties would not receive the payment of the taxes and the taxing districts. And so that might be another point that there's still some concern around this measure. The fiscal impact of the bill is a one-time cost of $125,000 for the Department of Revenue to update their computer system to calculate the compound interest as opposed to simple interest. And there's a revenue impact in 2011-13 of $11.2 million, and in 2013-15 of $19.6 million of some of the major components of this measure. And there are also, finally, just a number of administrative changes to improve the ability of Department of Revenue to collect, and just some technical changes that are included in the measure as well.
Thank you, committee. This has been one of the major projects of the revenue committees and the finance and revenue committee now this session. And we have had, I've been following from a safe distance the hard work of my counterparts in the House, and we have both of the co-chairs here today to testify on some of that work that's gone on, and I really appreciate you both coming.
I thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20, Madam Chair, members. I'm going to go first because I rushed from another meeting. I have no file in front of me, and if you want facts, they're next to me here. I will just tell you my journey. I became aware in the interim last fall that there was a huge issue with this program. This has been a program that has worked very, very well for the state in that we pay the property taxes, the state does, to the county. The counties are held whole. And then when the property is sold, either through estate or through a sale, we get back the money that we have essentially loaned with interest. The purpose, of course, is the critical thing. The idea is that as we age, change is harder, and there is a real reason to keep the disabled, it also includes the disabled, and the elderly or getting older in their own homes in their own situation. They do better. It is upsetting to have people have to leave their house, because particularly if their house gets so valuable they can't afford the taxes. Then there's also a group of people who are just plain poor, and their houses aren't worth a whole lot, and even keeping them in any house, it helps a lot to if we can take care of this property tax. What happened, there's some history here. The legislature has swept funds from here. That has been bad. And then the perfect storm of the collapse of the housing market has meant that these houses are no longer changing hands. So the fund we use to pay forward to pay these taxes is empty. We were alerted to that. I started meeting last fall with the Department of Revenue looking at what our options are. Other states have been in similar situations. I've heard that some have just dropped this program altogether. It was our goal, I think, not to do that. But it's also a program, because it's been sort of self-sustaining, that hasn't had a good look. We haven't. And that's part of the reason that she mentioned that there's a sunset in here. We think going forward it needs to have a legislative review more frequently to make sure that it's on track. And so that's one of the things that we put in this bill, is an automatic, you're going to have to look at it in a few years. But what we decided was, what are some reasonable sideboards so that we can get control of it and hopefully save it? Now, it needs a serious infusion of money. We get that. But what we are presenting to you is our best effort to come to terms to the sideboards that both protect the people who we feel benefit from this, and there's a lot of them, 10,000-some Oregonians who currently, we believe, are really served by this, and at the same time, going forward, have the right sideboards that some of the excesses that we did find, people who inappropriately were flipping houses and using this as a financing mechanism, that kind of thing, and there were some of those, let's get them out. And let's do a better oversight of the program and what the parameters should be. Senator Telfer was in on the beginning of this by phone. Remember that meeting? And we've gone on with it and worked it very hard in the House. We welcome your participation in this conversation. We hope that we can get the sideboards on it and then look to the future and figure out how to get it recapitalized, because we do think it adds a lot of value for a lot of Oregonians, and it's an important program.
Thank you for that summary, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Phil Barnhart, State Representative.
Okay, before you start, you said you have to brush off. Are there questions of Representative Berger? So you're free to leave any time.
Thank you, and thank you for your attention. This is an important program.
We know that. And thanks again for all your hard work.
Welcome, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it is true that this is the, I think this is the only work group that Representative Berger and I both participated in, because we thought this was so critically important. The program was established in the 70s. It was established at that point with a general fund loan. The loan was paid back over a period, I think, of about 10 years. and the program has been self-sustaining since that time. In 2003 and then finally in 2007 and 2009, funds in the neighborhood of $25 million were swept from this account and spent on other things against my rather loud objection. And my loud objection had to do with the fact that I thought the fund could not sustain that kind of fund sweep, that it needed the money itself in order to maintain itself. It turned out I was right, and it's too bad that I was right. But in the process, we did find a number of issues that needed to be dealt with. We established a number of things in this bill to deal with those issues. A couple of key things that have not been mentioned so far, the current law does not require that the owner have owned and occupied the house for any period of time when they join the program, which means that you could use this mechanism as a part of the finance for getting into the house in the first place. And it just so happened that when we were talking about this, the two foreclosures that had occurred in which we were wiped out because the loan amount was more than the value of the house were exactly that, where the owners had gotten into the home and gotten on the program the same year. One of the provisions is that you have to be in the home for at least 5 years before you can qualify at all. Another one that has not been mentioned is that there's an income qualification. Currently, it's indexed. Currently, the amount is $39,500. If you have household income that's greater than that, you don't qualify. Because of the way the Revenue Department has been managing this program, that really only applied for 1 year. After that, they depended on tax returns to help them figure out whether people continue to qualify or not. And as Senator Telfer's counterpart on our committee pointed out, that doesn't cover all income. It only covers part of income. So we established a requirement that there actually be a reapplication and a re-qualification, I believe, every 2 years. That hasn't been the case either before. Then we set up asset qualifications other than the house. If you have a lot of assets, you don't qualify. One of the key points to be aware of, and as we think about this, Representative Berger already made, and that is if you have a person or a couple who've been living in a house for a long time, keeping them there tends to keep them happier. It probably significantly reduces their medical bills. Obviously, it costs us less money because if we don't have to house them somewhere else. And therefore, not only do they win, but the state wins too because we spend less money. And this money we get back when the house is sold. So it is a win-win as far as I'm concerned. Keeps people in their homes, reduces our costs, and we recover that money at the time that the house is sold, so that ultimately it doesn't cost the state any money. We believe that there is a potential way of financing this program with the sideboards that this bill establishes. We don't think there's any possibility of financing it under the current law. So I believe that this bill or something very close to it is essential in order to keep this program going. I think for all the reasons we've said, this is a great program. We need to keep it going. There are some outliers that we can take off of the program by requiring reapplication by everybody, and which is part of the bill, and thereby eliminating some who probably shouldn't qualify. But those who need the support to stay in their own homes, this becomes a piece of that process, along with things like Dial-A-Ride, OPI, and other things that may be helpful. And has the huge advantage to us, saves us money, and makes people a lot happier.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. And again, thank you for your hard work on this. This was a program that was very much in need of the detailed analysis that you gave it in House Revenue. Are there questions? Senator Hess.
Thank you. Many thanks to you, Representative, for your hard work on this. As the Chair said, it was much needed. I was just wondering about the 6% interest figure down the road. And, you know, I mean, given the cost of borrowing today, that's really higher than you could get it in conventional rates for a 30-year loan. And I realize this makes the problem worse, but was there any thought of lowering that to help people like you're describing to actually stay in their own home, to at least get it down to what the going rate is now?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Hass, we had the opposite discussion. We were concerned with how we were going to finance this program. Right now, the fund is empty.
Right.
We need to come up with over $20 million a year in order to pay, and that should be paid on November 15th to the county tax collector, in order for the county to distribute the funds to the people who receive the property taxes. So our discussion was actually the opposite of reducing it. The reason why somebody might buy into this kind of a program even now is that they may have difficulty qualifying for other kinds of loans because of their asset situation and the like. This is not a loan program that somebody would do, I think, if they had other options available to them to borrow money at a lower interest rate. There are some advantages to it. Now, the typical person occupies a home after they have gone into this program for about 7 years. That would be the average. So we're not talking about a long period of time for most people. There are obviously outliers. So the interest rate difference is not a huge item for that. Using this approach, we think we're in a position where we believe that we can probably save the program, which making any significant changes to either the sideboards or the interest rate may not make that possible.
Yes, and the interest payment is not due until the property sells.
We add it. That's exactly right. We add it, Madam Chair. We add it to the amount of the amount due, and when the property is sold, in closing, we'll receive the portion that the state has paid plus the interest.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along those lines, I can't remember what the average property tax amount is that's being deferred. It's not a huge amount, but by making this compound interest versus simple interest as well, kind of gets rid of some of the abusive usage of this. So I can't remember, Representative Barnhart, how much the average. It was not high. So that compounding this versus simple and raising it a small amount is not going to have a major impact on keeping somebody in their home.
Right.
But it will help fund the program.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, that's exactly right. I don't remember the exact number either, but some of the sideboards that we put on having to do with the value of the house itself will also tend to limit the amount we spend on any one property.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Thank you. Thank you also for all the work that you've done on this. Very good. Did you consider indexing it to LIBOR or something? And the reason I ask that is because fixed rates don't always reflect changing conditions when you have, you know, high and low interest rates. LIBOR is a commonly used index in financing to set the rates, and, you know, it's a LIBOR. It's a London Interbank Borrowing Rate is what it is, and it's pretty universally used.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we didn't actually talk about that. I suspect that LIBOR is pretty low right now because Mr. Bernanke has been working really hard to keep interest rates zero or negative. I suspect that's pretty low. Part of what we're trying to do, when you think about this fund, being a revolving fund, the way in which the fund grows is by accumulating the interest that it collects. The actual interest rate in the real world may be less important than that function for helping to grow the fund. That's the way it was possible in the 70s to pay off that initial general fund loan, and the way it will be possible, ultimately, we hope, to pay off whatever financing we're able to deal with this time, and allow the fund to grow. As property taxes increase just with inflation, as the number of people on the system increase, which I suspect will happen at probably pretty close to the rate of the cap, being able to collect interest will allow the fund to grow a little bit. This interest doesn't go anywhere else; it stays in the fund. I know that's not completely responsive to your question, but I think it's a little different animal than a typical financing kind of idea.
It's a heck of a lot lower than credit card interest.
Madam Chair, I have the answer to my question.
Oh, good.
From our staff, it's about $2,000 a year.
The average property
tax payment. The
average, yeah,
tax payment that we're...
Thank you for gathering that. Other questions? Thank you. At this time, we're going to be skipping around a little bit, audience, so fasten your seatbelts. We're going to recess the public hearing before you leave. Representative Barnhart will recess the public hearing on House Bill 2543 and simultaneously open public hearings on House Bill 2546, 3261, and 2546, 3261, and 2572 for the convenience of Representative Barnhart. And Christine, you have all those bills.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2546, the A version, would allow the late filing of a claim for exemption from property taxation for up to 5 years prior to the current tax year, with a late filing fee, which is the greater of $200 or 0.1% of the value of the property, and it's multiplied by the number of tax years for which the exemption is claimed. The measure provides a tax to be refunded without interest for exempt property for which the claim is filed late. And the amendment would also restrict the late filing for property tax exemptions to public entities, first-time filers, or any other filers would have to show good cause of failing to file a timely claim. There is an A2 amendment with this measure that actually brings in a tax exemption for food processing equipment, and it is currently not a fiscal impact statement or a revenue impact statement on that amendment. This amendment would extend this exemption for a period of 4 years. It's currently sunsetting on July 1st, 2011, and this would change the sunset to 2015 to make a 4-year extension.
3261.
Sure. Moving on, House Bill 3261 would provide the Department of Revenue be able to issue tax warrants to the county and eventually sell taxpayers' real or personal property. The measure allows the department to notify the taxpayer and actually requires that notification that there is a warrant against their property and allows them to make payments or figure out the payment plan prior to actually bringing the sheriff in and repossessing property. This measure would apply to warrants issued by the department on or after January 1st, 2012. There is a fiscal impact statement of a minimal fiscal and statement of no revenue impact on this measure.
And the last one is 2572.
House Bill 2572 would allow any other party in a property tax appeal case to seek a determination of the entire value of the property, as opposed to just maybe the case might be pertaining to some component of the value that might be overvalued, and the taxpayer has picked up on that value to get a reduction and can therefore get a reduction on the total property. commensurate with that. But if other parts of the property tax account are overvalued, this would allow the assessor or some other party to the appeal to seek a determination of the entire value and reestablish it as a whole rather than just having that part reduced. There's a fiscal impact of no expenditure impact on this measure, and the revenue impact would be indeterminate but positive because the assessor could potentially get the value to be increased as a whole in response to attempts to just decrease one component of value that are currently being made.
Okay, thank you. Representative Barnhart, you can take them in any order you want.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11, and I'm going to take them in the order that they were presented. I think that's probably a little less confusing. The first bill having to do with the issue of actual filing for an exemption, this bill applies to nonprofits and churches and groups like that that are required to file a notice with the assessor to claim the exemption from property taxes. It came to my attention as a result of an unfortunate problem that arose from a church in Cresswell that had leased their Sunday school space to a nonprofit daycare program. Neither one of them realized that they needed to file a notice, or actually a couple of notices, with the county assessor to claim the exemption for the use of the church Sunday school by the other nonprofit for a daycare program during the week. If the church had been putting on the daycare program themselves, they wouldn't have had to do anything. That resulted in a substantial tax bill. This bill does not apply to the story I've just told you because it's only prospective. It only goes forward. But what it does is it allows nonprofits, first-time filers, these organizations that often do not have a lawyer on the staff, often work, through their board of deacons or their nonprofit volunteer board, to file a late notice claiming the exemption up to 5 years later. In order to do that, they have to pay a fine, essentially a fine of $200 or a percentage of the value of the real property. And the point of this, of course, is to encourage people to file on time when they're supposed to and not file these things late. It seems to me that accomplishes the goals of the assessor and keeping the property values the exemptions properly in the record, but at the same time doesn't penalize somebody who misses the deadline in the way they're penalized now, because they actually had to pay the property taxes that would be due for non-exempt property, even though what they were doing was an exempt effort. Now that's the first one. You may want to ask questions, or you may want me to go on with the others.
Representative Barnhart, we have an amendment. We're using this bill potentially for another amendment. Have you had a chance to look at the dash two?
I don't have a position on that amendment. What I know about it is that it extends an exemption which is expiring for food processing equipment. I think it applies primarily in the Salem area, although it doesn't legally apply to just the Salem area. And I suspect my co-chair, who is not here now, may have more to say about that, but I don't.
Okay, but you don't have a problem with it, do you know?
I don't have a position about it at all.
Okay, thank you. Okay, move on.
Thank you. The next one, it came to my attention as a result of...
And that would be House Bill 3261?
Yes, thank you. House Bill 3261, the tax warrant issue. To simplify, the current law says that if there are taxes due and they're late in whatever way the law requires, and I forget exactly how that's defined, the department has to issue a warrant to the sheriff. The sheriff has to go levy on the property. That's what the law currently says, in short. In fact, they don't actually do that. If a person comes into the department and says, yes, I owe these taxes, yes, I'll pay them, let's write an agreement about how I'm going to pay them, and they establish a payment plan. The purpose of the warrant does a couple of things currently. It requires the sheriff to levy on the property. It also establishes a priority for the taxes due against real property and other things that might be recorded in the deed records. So the point of this bill is to separate those two functions. They can file a warrant that establishes the lien on the real property without having the sheriff levy against real and personal property at the discretion of the department. And of course, they would exercise that discretion when a person has reached an agreement to pay the taxes over time, unless, of course, they quit doing that. I think all this bill does, and you may want to ask the department, but I think all this bill does is conform the current statute to the current practice.
Okay. Last one, House Bill 2572.
Madam Chair, this came to our attention from the assessor's offices. It has to do with the rule that says if there's more than one component in a property tax assessment, a taxpayer can appeal the valuation of one or more of the components without appealing the value of the whole thing. And that's apparently been on the books for a long time. And under normal circumstances, it's a good rule because there's no point in having in dispute formally more than what's actually in dispute. But because of Measure 50, which has its absolute limits on the valuation of property and the way that valuation is set up, if a component is misassessed too high, and some other component is misassessed too low, the taxpayer could easily end up with a market value and an assessed value, which is lower than it should have been, through the mechanism of forcing down the assessment of one component and not having an adjustment in a different component that was underassessed. So the assessors have asked to have this bill adopted so that in the event that was happening, they could open the entire account and get the local appeals board and the tax court to consider all of the components of a property rather than simply the ones that the taxpayer wanted to bring. I think that there have been some examples that you may have already seen that suggest that this would remove a tactic that would unfairly lower the assessed value of the market value and therefore the assessed value of a property, would thereby increase the fairness of the property tax system. I'm not claiming that currently our property tax system under Measure 50 and Measure 5 is fair, but this would improve it to a small degree.
Thank you. Senator Telfer.
Question on the 2572. It's a component assessment issue, obviously, but is the problem really not the residual methodology that we're using or Measure 50 and that this really is not the best fix for this problem?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I agree if what you're saying is let's amend the Constitution and fix Measure 50. I would certainly agree that that would be a better solution. I don't even know what the other part of your question means, so I'll pass on that part.
Well, to follow up with an explanation, because, you know, I think this takes away some rights of the taxpayer, because what happens is with the residual methodology, they value something, and then the rest of it is whatever's left, you know, usually the land. And you know, now you open up Pandora's box if you want to contest a component. Now the whole thing gets revalued. And it's the residual methodology that's the problem also, in that they're, you know, they're picking one thing and valuing it, knowing that the whole is supposed to be X amount of dollars, and that just means it's kind of like land use. You know, you either got commercial, residential, and what's left is EFU, because you have no definition for anything else. And so, I don't know. I'm not sure that this is the fix, and I think this may do more harm to the taxpayer with this approach.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I think that might be the case, except that you cannot get an assessment which is higher than the assessed value plus 3% now. And that's what saves you from the problem you're concerned about. If Measure 50 did not exist, I think it's only Measure 50. I think if Measure 50 did not exist, this would be utterly unnecessary.
But could that not be a problem depending on when something was, an improvement was put on the land based on when the land came onto the tax rolls? I mean, we have some issues in Bend where next door neighbors are paying five times as much in property taxes because of the timing of putting the improvement on.
Right.
So I can see where you've had a big problem there.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I completely agree with that issue. In the House Revenue Committee, we had a long testimony during the interim on precisely this issue. It's not directly related to this bill, but it's definitely a problem with Measure 50. And in my opinion, I'd repeal Measure 50, or at least modify it in some very significant ways to deal with exactly the issue you're talking about. But that doesn't have anything to do with, I don't believe, with this bill, because all this bill does is prevents a tactic that would allow a taxpayer to artificially lower his market value in some circumstances to the detriment of other taxpayers and to the funds where the taxes flow to. I would agree that if Measure 50 were repealed, repealing this would be fine.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to tackle that one.
Thank you. Eventually, we will
eventually
get to
this. Eventually, we'll tackle it. But.
Okay. Looks like there's no further questions. Thank you,
Representative Barnhart,
and thank you for coming. Okay, we will recess the public hearings on House Bill 2546, House Bill 3261, and House Bill 2572, and open a work session on House Bill 3188. That's Masson's bill. Thank you for your patience, Representative Wand. Why don't you come on up to the table if there are any questions?
Mr. Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 3188, you've heard on the 25th of April, and at that time, I think there were some discussions about how or if the necessity for the bill and the language and the different amendments, if needed at all. And I guess at this time, come back to discuss it. Just to refresh your memory, this is about the lottery and the economic development by the counties, and having that to be on the website of DAS in the government transparency website.
Okay, and Representative Wand is here, and maybe you could just, we had it after our hearing, we appointed Senator Telfer and you and a couple of the county people to be in a work group. Maybe you could just, with the help of Senator Telfer, report on that.
Thank you. We spoke with Mr. Moody.
Can you introduce yourself?
Sorry, Matthew Wand, state representative from House District 49 in Troutdale. We spoke with Mr. Moody, who is an auditor, CPA, and he discussed with us the provisions of the bill and whether or not complying with the bill would cause our counties to have unfavorable audit reports. And what he reported back to us is that in looking at the measure and how the term accounting fund is defined, it would be just fine, and that in counties where this is a lot of money as a percentage of their budget, then part of their traditional audit function would be to take a closer look at this. And in counties where this is not a large percentage of their total county budget, then it would be lumped in together with the minor funds, and it would be audited in that way. He didn't see any problems with it, and so we're back here with the same bill.
And no amendments?
Correct.
After your work, okay. Senator Telford, did you have anything to add?
No. It was good that we talked to the municipal auditors, because they did have some heartburn when they first read the bill, but I think the explanation, the clarification of things was fine, that we're not changing the audit rules or making additional rules for them above and beyond the AICPA. So it was good work. It's a good bill now.
I see county people in the audience and no mad gesticulations or chest pounding, so I presume we're okay on that. So thank you for coming, Representative Wand. We are in work session on House Bill 3188. Senator Morris, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3188A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 3188A to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Again, I want to thank you, Senator Telfer, for drilling down on this. Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Telfer, would you like to carry this?
Certainly.
Okay. Now we're going to open a work session, a very quick work session, on Senate Bill 984. Because we're helping our staff get their exercise today.
Chair, voting members of the committee, as you recall from the public hearing, under this bill, a local government employer is allowed to work with the Oregon Employment Department so that it does not overpay into its unemployment insurance account, and can seek an extended payment plan in replenishing insufficient account balance. Senator Starr introduced the bill, and Employment Department supports the bill with the blessing of the governor's office.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Starr came to testify. There was no opposition, as I recall. And we are in work session. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 984 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved Senate Bill 984 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we will ask Senator Starr if he would like to carry this bill. Okay. Now what should we do? Now we will... I don't see Mr. Nelson in the office. So we will open a... work session. We will not move this bill today, but we will open a work session on House Bill 2238 for purposes of discussing an amendment.
Mr. Burdick, I'm back with another softball. No, we've done this one, sorry. 2238 is in front of you, this, the gist of it primarily, the bill tries, or the amended bill, allows for the woodland lot owners to register their vehicles as farm trucks and farm vehicles. And that schedule of registration, vehicle registration, is significantly different in the amounts that it levies rather than the regular registration schedule. And that is in your SMS. I put the differences between those two registration types. Of course, the bill as in the A engrossed version, we found it to have a revenue impact of about slightly more than $2 million a year. And then, of course, that's a $4 million biennium. This is not a growth industry, so we don't, or a growth number, so we don't expect it to keep growing. So this is what we had Last time we didn't have all that information for you, and just before the meeting here today, we just received a dash 3 amendment, and I think with the dash 3 amendment, and I will ask Mr. Byer to talk about it, but the dash 3 amendment, I think, caps that revenue impact at $250,000 a year, or about $500,000 a biennium, if I understand it correctly.
Okay, and Roger Byer, if you'd come up and just say a couple words about the amendment, and then we don't have any paperwork or anything on this. We'll let the committee review the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Byer, here representing Oregon Small Woodlands on House Bill 2238. Madam Chair, the revenue impact that was issued was somewhat of a surprise to us, because we were led to believe by Department of Transportation this bill had very minimal fiscal impact. That was their version when the bill left the House committee, that the bill had, their words were, so small it was incalculable revenue impact. So obviously the House used that information when they passed this bill. So I guess my members feel the bill is important, and they're willing to put their own money where their thoughts are, by saying that if their thoughts are wrong and that the revenue impact is as big as what the revenue committee staff calculated, that they would take, you know, they would limit the use of it up to a certain amount. The $250,000 number would allow for approximately 600 vehicles a year to be registered this way, by the numbers that Mr. Mazin calculated, at approximately $400 per vehicle per year savings. So we think that is probably more than people who would apply to use this, they would have the ability to use this type of a plate on their woodlands, but we're willing to take that chance if you are willing to pass the bill and cap the amount that would be allowed. Along with the amendment came a letter from Legislative Council questioning the constitutionality of the amendment, but I think it said, the last sentence says it all. It says, it is likely that the bill, if it were to become law, would survive a challenge. So I think it rationalizes, much like we do in healthcare all the time, that when you run out of money, you run out of money. And that is a compelling reason for the legislature to cap something, is the lack of money. So,
I'm just wondering how, Mazin, maybe this is a question for you, how it got out of the House with minimal revenue impact and then all of a sudden came into a big revenue impact.
Sure. Madam Chair, actually, this was, how would you say it, when the process breaks down kind of thing. The revenue impact statement that was on the bill was a revenue light, which meant that we expect to examine this measure in the revenue committee when it comes to the revenue committee, and basically allowed it, they gave it the revenue impact statement, and you probably have a copy of that, just to allow it to move to the revenue committee. Now, somehow it moved through the House floor with the revenue light, which should probably have never happened. And unfortunately, it's one of those things that kind of should not have happened. And
So basically, but I don't see a subsequent here. So it went right from Agriculture and Natural Resources in the House to the floor. It never went to House Revenue?
Yes.
Oh, got it. Okay. All right. That means they didn't get their hands on it.
Right.
You could have just said it real short.
Well, the difference, Chair Burdick, is that we actually, in the revenue impact statement, said that this, we would look at it in the revenue committee and requested the revenue referral to it. So we would look at it. And the revenue light, as designed, we have revenue light and fiscal light as in the process to move the bills quicker within between committees. And revenue light and fiscal light are never meant to go to the floor.
But the subsequent that you were expecting did not happen.
Right.
Okay. That's a useful explanation. Thank you. Anything to add, Roger?
No.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, there's new terminology, Mazen, if you could explain what a smother sum is.
Let me see.
That's a new one. I have never heard.
I've not seen that.
It's on the revenue impact statement.
Smother sum.
The last sentence in the
smother sum.
Major paragraph.
That's must be a new one. Yes. In the last paragraph. Oh, of course, yes. But this means when you go quickly as a woodland park and crows faster.
What are you talking about?
He's making it up.
I wanted to say smoother sum. It just another time when the process breaks down and the spell checker does not catch that.
I thought maybe it was a new economic term.
There's a grammatical mistake in the same line, Mazen. Okay.
Well, sorry.
All right, we'll send him back to grammar school. All right. Thank you, Roger, for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I think that probably was talked about is having. This is almost establishing a medallion type of in the process for the A3. That's I noticed. So that probably has to be looked at.
Okay. All right. Let's see. We're going to close the public hearing. We're going to close the work session on House Bill 2238. And then I have to look at my sign-ups and see who is least likely to be able to come back. I think we will We will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2543, and we also intend to continue this on Friday at our meeting if there are other people who want to testify, but we got a couple people signed up today, and so we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2543. And Christine has already summarized this. We've heard from Representative Berger and Representative Barnhart. We'll call up John Phillips on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue, and I just signed up to be here so that if you had any questions, I think the co-chairs and staff did an excellent job of.
Great, thank you. Why don't you just stand by in the audience, because I missed my first sign-up sheet. I meant to get Rick Bennett and Jeb Tompkins.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for ARP Oregon, and I appreciate this opportunity. While the bill is scheduled for Friday as well, I'm not available on Friday, so I appreciate to get something on the record. Here in support of House Bill 2543, I participated in some of the discussions last fall related to the deferral program, as well as participating in the work group led by co-chairs Barnhart and Berger this session. I appreciate the intent of everyone involved in those discussions to try and find a way to continue this program. Certainly there are issues related to both the current financial situation the program is in, as well as trying to develop some sideboards that in fact would allow the program to be sustainable over a longer period of time. And I think 2543 is a really good product related to those discussions that we've had. Many options were considered. A lot of what-if questions were asked related to those options, and I think some of the, certainly the changing the simple interest to compound interest and the 5% cap certainly is recognition of a need to present a viable option related to possibly seeking a loan for the short-term financial needs of the program, as well as being able to show that, in fact, the program over time will be able to pay back a loan if that is the mechanism used to keep the program going. And at the same time, a recognition that while it is really important that this program continue and allow people to age in place, that's a term that it, we use at AARP, to age in place and to continue to stay in their communities and to maintain that social network that individuals develop over time, that in fact this program could not be, you know, necessarily all things to all people. And there was a need to provide some limits to the participation in the program. And I think what you have before you is more of a really reasonable, moderate kind of proposal to do that. And I think, though, it's important to recognize that there will be some individuals who are currently in the program that when they seek to recertify for continued participation will not meet the requirements as laid out in this bill. But again, I think it's a matter of trying to present, develop a situation where the program can be sustained over a longer period of time. And we think that's very important, and we support the bill.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Berg, members of the commission. I'm Jed Tompkins, assistant Multnomah County attorney. We support this bill as well. And I just have one point of interest that I'd like to offer for your consideration. I'm here to talk about one of the issues that legislative staff described, and this is the cap on new participants. If you're interested, it's on page 6 of the bill. It's lines 20 through 24. As the bill stands, the cap on new participants is based on the amount of tax imposed. That's the language in the bill. And this setting up that scheme greatly favors participants from counties with lower taxes, as described by legislative revenue staff, over those claimants or applicants from counties with higher taxes. And that's just without regard to any particular taxpayer's need for assistance. Our suggestion is that the cap on new participants should just be based on the same factors used earlier in the bill to determine who initially qualifies for the program, and that's real market value of the homestead, the county median value, and the number of years that the applicant has been in the home. This would normalize the cap as applied across the counties and has the added benefit of making the test for new claimants similar to the test for getting into the program in the first place.
Okay. Mr. Bennett, did you have any comment on that suggestion?
Madam Chair, I had a chance to look at the amending language just before the hearing started. I don't have a position on that. We did consider several options kind of at the last minute because the 5% cap was something that really came up after the work group had really finished meeting and so forth. The issue of the ascending order, descending order, first come, first served, a lottery, I mean, those were all options looking at if, in fact, you had more initial claimants than that would be allowed under the 5% cap, how would you deal with them and so forth. Each one of those options had pluses and minuses to it. I don't have a position on this particular option. One of the things we did consider in talking about a number of these options, though, was the ease of administration, both for the Department of Revenue as well as county government. Mm-hmm. And so I think I would defer to the Department of Revenue as to how they would utilize this particular mechanism.
Thank you. I would like, I am interested in pursuing this, so let's try to all work together and see if we can come up with something that would address those concerns. Questions from the committee? Mr. Phillips, do you have any comments on anything?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, John Phillips, Department of Revenue. Just relating to this bill, you mean, or just anything?
I'd like to respond. Oh, it's getting late in the session. If you have any comments on what Multnomah County was suggesting and how we might proceed with their concerns, which I think are legitimate and in some way that would have ease of administration, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is to take that back and look at it, you know, ask the program folks to take a look at that, see what it involves. And the one thing I might point out is that this deals with a cap for new applicants after the first year. So this coming fall, there'll be a category of new applicants. And let me just give you an example. Let's say there's 1,000 new applicants. Now, that will create the base for the 2012 cap. So the cap really is on the first year will be the 2012 year. So that will be capped at 1,000 in this example, plus 5%. So we do have some time to implement a change. You know, if it's, I don't think it's that complicated, I don't know. But this would apply to the 2012 year in the first time. So if you had 1,060 individuals apply, we would have to take that 1,060 because it's 10 persons over the limit. And then we would apply this to all the counties and their median RMB and their all these factors, and then sort that, and 10 people would not qualify. So that's kind of how we see it working, just from what we've read.
Okay, great. Well, we want to get something that does a job that has the biggest ease of administration. So
thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
We're going to hold on to this for a little while, so we got a little time to think. Okay, anybody else want to talk about anything on this bill? We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2543 and open a public hearing on... I got too much paper up here. On House Bill 2238. No. No. On 2546. You can see Roger Beyer out there having a heart attack. Okay. We had testimony from Representative Barnhart. There is no one else signed up, but Mr. Nelson has an amendment, the Dash 2 amendment, that I wanted to bring to the committee to see if that was an amendment that interested people.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Northwest Food Processors Association. In 2005, this body passed the Oregon's food processing machinery and equipment property tax exemption. It's been a vital tool since that time for creating jobs in our state's third largest manufacturing sector. Without this amendment, because the exemption expires on July 1 this year, July 1, 2011, we would lose this valuable tool. Basically, it works very simply. Madam Chair, the food processor manufacturer comes to the county assessor, makes application, submits a schedule of food processing equipment, either acquisitions or upgrades, and that is involved in perhaps an expansion or an upgrade of a particular line. And we receive, once it goes, if it's approved as qualifying by the assessor, gets a five-year property tax exemption. I want to emphasize that this is a temporary exemption. After 5 years, all that equipment, everything comes back online. In terms of the assessment, it allows for the investment by the manufacturer and has helped create jobs. And I think it's very evident what's happened since that time. In 3 years prior to 2005, employment in Oregon's vegetable fruit processing sector had declined by 15%. Payroll had been down by 11%. The estimate by economists was for the next 10 years is that we would continue to see job losses in this manufacturing segment. With this exemption, which the industry credits with having a major turnaround in the industry, as this industry was the only manufacturing sector that actually increased jobs, added jobs in 2008 and 2009. In 2008, we had about 25 food processors petition counties that increased property, increased investments in machinery in over three plants across the state of Oregon. The industry continues to flourish in this state, and we've given you some examples in our handwritten material as some of that those investments have been made. Now, those are not just simple investments in just machinery that they received a property tax exemption on, but these are investments in plants that included machinery as well as expansion, building of additional buildings, et cetera. Again, I want to emphasize that this this property tax exemption is a temporary investment in the manufacturing sector in this state. As they make those investments, they create jobs, they expand their industry, and modernize. After 5 years, everything comes back onto the rolls.
Okay. And this is at the option of the county, correct?
That is, it's the option that the county, if they approve the application, I think I had given you perhaps a different sheet than what appears here. When we had done the analysis, our analysis by the Food Processors Association had indicated that the counties had an option. But if we qualify, they have to give it. But it is, again, temporary in nature.
Okay. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anybody else signed up on this?
I'm not signed up, Madam Chair.
Yeah, come on, Gil. Yes, please.
Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. Just to give you a little bit of background, fill out the background that Mark gave you. This was a long-negotiated temporary program that took us weeks. It was Department of Agriculture, Department of Revenue, the Association of Counties, and the food processors to identify the kind of sideboards that would deal with, at that time, a very crisis situation. We were about to lose some processors. They were going to go underwater because of international competition and so on. I would have appreciated some heads up about this, and certainly we could work through this, but this hasn't been reviewed by any of the other parties to this agreement at all. This is just been unveiled. So I understand the immediacy, the need for the immediacy, but it does extend for 4 years. You've got two sessions in the meantime. So just to put that on the record, this was thought through in great detail, and we haven't had an opportunity to look at this program since.
So what are you saying? Are you opposing this amendment?
No, I'm not, Madam Chair. I guess I would say that maybe if the extension of the sunset, if you deem it appropriate, would be for a couple of years, so we have an opportunity to sit down again and see if the standards for the program still fit current situation. Not every food processor qualifies for this. There are certain standards that the food processor has to meet. Madam Chair, it's just something for the record. If you want to move the bill, I'm not going to object. I just wanted to put that on the record that it would have been nice to have a conversation about this first so we could inform you fully about the program.
Okay. Well, we're not going to move this today, so let's continue the conversation. Senator Telfer.
Can I just ask Gil a question?
Yeah.
When you suggest extending the sunset for just a couple of years, I'm trying to flesh that out because if I'm buying a bunch of equipment, yeah, I'd like a little more certainty.
Sure.
Than just a couple of years, because it's expensive equipment and it factors into my decision on whether to buy this piece of equipment, that one, or not replace equipment.
Certainly. Well, Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, that points out how important this program is and we should have, why it's coming up all of a sudden. we should have had an opportunity, all the parties to the original design of the program, to talk about it. I guess that's, I just want to put that on the record.
Madam Chair, it might not be
Moore.
Too late to convene a little bit of a conference.
Yeah, let's sit down and talk again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's two of them in the room.
Maybe we could bring Mr. Nelson back and get your perspective on this.
Madam Chair, Mark Nelson again, and I apologize. Extension, I wasn't part of the 2005 bill. Robbie Douglas represented the food processors at that point, and I wasn't privy to the fact that there were other parties involved that. So I apologize. The extension is there, July 1, 2011. It's in another bill in the House that had many, many other things in it that was subject to many other issues, and they decided not to move that particular bill. And that's why Representative Berger suggested I go on a hunt and try to find another bill to put it into. So I thought everyone was aware that this thing was going to sunset. And it works like this. You have to apply before July 1, 2011 to get the 5 years. So after July 1, 2011, it's done. So if we don't have this in there, we don't have this tool anymore. So it's dead as of July 1, 2011.
But if someone applied, getting to Senator Telfer's point, if somebody applied on June 30th, 2011, they'd still get their full 5 years.
That's correct.
So that is not a concern. I'm thinking that maybe given the fact that you haven't looked at the program as a group, as a part of the original group, maybe a shorter sunset might be in order. To give you a chance to reevaluate the program.
Sure, Madam Chair, we're perfectly open to that, and I didn't mean to surprise anybody today. I thought everyone was aware the sunset was there.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe you could go get an amendment to shorten the sun. Work with Mr. Riddell and and get a little bit shorter sunset so that we can solve those concerns.
Thank you.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left here, so I've got a couple people signed up on, so we'll close the public hearing on that bill, and we will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2572 and bring Gil and Bob Broman back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob's going to be in Texas on Friday, so we appreciate you.
Oh, I wish you'd let me know before that, because we're almost out of time.
Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here in support of the bill, and I just want to make a couple of very simple points, and then Bob can give you the nuts and bolts. Like virtually every other property tax bill, it looks complicated and arcane, but it's really pretty simple. What the bill does not do, it does not prohibit or otherwise affect the right of a taxpayer to appeal the value of just one component of their property. What it does do is it permits the magistrate or the judge in the property tax appeal to ensure that the correct final valuation of property is made in the process of making the component value adjustment. And that's really it, sum total.
Okay. Mr. Broman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bob Roman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor and also the President of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, who I am representing today. We support this bill. Representative Barnhart, I think, actually explained it pretty well and got to kind of the nuts and bolts of it. But under existing law, taxpayers are allowed to appeal just one component of their value, for instance, of their total value, and it would be land and potentially buildings. They could appeal buildings only or land only. And that's a good thing. And as Mr. Riddell pointed out, we're not trying to take that away. There are good reasons for that to be able to be accomplished. However, under the existing law, it doesn't permit the assessor to defend the total value of the property in that type of appeal. And we have an example in the testimony that we provided for you. And very quickly, if you had a property that was worth $1 million and we had on the tax roll $900,000 on the improvements and $100,000 on the land, and the taxpayer was appealing only the improvement value, and in order to persuade the court about a reduction in that improvement value, he chose to try to prove that the land value should be $400,000 instead of $100,000. And if he was successful, that would result, again, in a market value for the improvements of $600,000. We could not contest the existing land value on the roll, so it would result in a market value that would be $700,000 for a property with a real market value, really, of $1 million. And so all we're asking is that we, as a party to a component value appeal, be able to bring in the total value to make sure we get a total real market value that's correct for the property. And as Representative Barnhart pointed out, this is really important under Measure 50, because if it's in the first year that a property is going on the roll, it's possible that this could result in an assessed value that may be lower than it would normally be using a valuation of the total property. And that's a life sentence under Measure 50, to the extent that we operate today. I mean, it could be, and you had some discussion on it, you know, we really only have a fair property tax system, not necessarily a fair property tax system. And this bill does preserve some of the integrity and equality in establishing real market values for property, and we would hope that you would support it, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions.
Okay, any quick questions? We're kind of running out of time here, but we have still, Mr. Broman will not be back on Friday, so thank you, Mr. Broman. It looks like we got you in the nick of time.
And I thank you, Chair Burdick, and thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we will carry over. We have no one else signed up. We will carry. This one is already listed for Friday, so we will carry. We will close the public hearing for now on House Bill 2572. And in addition to House Bill 2543 and 2572, which are all already scheduled for Friday, we will carry over House Bill 2238, House Bill 2546, and House Bill 3261. Committee, I'm trying to get our time changed since we're under 1 hour notice for Friday, and I'll let you know if I'm successful in that endeavor. And we are adjourned.